You're listening to the Food Talk Show. Hi there, my name is Sue Nelson, and for the next hour we're going to be talking about all things food. We had a fascinating programme last week with Caroline Steele, and we were discussing the latest Great British Chefs research, which has just come out with Ollie Lloyd. Hi, Ollie.
Hi, how's it going?
Yeah, it's a good programme, wasn't it? We've got a second programme on your research this week as well, because we just couldn't cover it all last week.
Great to be talking about again. It's really interesting stuff.
It is really interesting stuff. And we're joined, as usual, by Gal.
You did that last week as well.
I did that last week as well. I don't know what's going on.
You put your teeth in, Sue.
Routledge.
Thank you.
Of Sapling Digital. And, of course, he's co-founder of the Food Rush.
That's right.
Some really interesting things about processed food in particular, I think. And also last week, this very nice feeling that somehow people are starting to go back towards their local,
butchers, their local fishmongers. Yeah, absolutely. It's great. Some really encouraging stats, some surprising ones as well. Obviously, lots of numbers and data to get our heads around. And of course, the research itself, people can go and download on the website, so you can have a look at the thing that we're talking about as we're talking about it.
Very useful stuff. And we're joined by Julie Bennett. Now, Julie's been on the programme before, and she is a futurist. And she had, last programme you were on, you had some fascinating insights into what you think the future was going to be. Not just like next year, but 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. So I'm hoping you'll give us your views on some of the research.
It's a pleasure to be back, and I love data.
You love data. Great. Yeah, so we've got a good sort of commentary.
No doubt.
Now, for people who didn't listen to the programme last week, do you just want to very, very quickly explain that this research is about food is and what that means? So just give us a little bit of a scene setting before we start.
Yeah, so the data we're going to be talking about today is based on a national panel of 3,000 people that we commissioned via a third-party research company called SSI to essentially understand the state of play in the world of food in Britain. And we also did a similar piece of research with our audience of Great British Chefs consumers. And essentially we've then segmented that data into three groups, what we call committed foodies, weekend foodies, and home cooks. And that's based upon the number of statements they agree with.
So. And these statements are heavily sort of food orientated. So, I like cooking from scratch. I seek out new food experiences. These people are really into food, aren't they?
Yeah. When we originally did the research in 2017, we had 40 different statements. And these were the statements that basically pulled people apart and we found to be the ones that helped identify foodies. So it wasn't, it's not just this random group of 10 statements. Mm. We worked out which of the 10 statements were best at helping indicate who was a foodie.
So we've got all this research. So one of the things we're going to look at today and things that came out, which I was stunned by, I think, there's an urban myth that young people aren't cooking. Now, that is not borne out by your research at all, is it? The young are cooking.
No, and we saw this for the first time last year. And I suppose, there's often been this sort of mythology that, people who are young just sort of eat ready meals and don't eat properly. But actually, I think that the younger generation have lived more through the food, revolution than those oldies like us. and therefore, I think there's kind of, they are just more engaged in the world of food. And so they are cooking from scratch more than, your average group.
It's funny. I mean, I would never have, I would probably put myself in the young foodie category.
You are younger.
In the 24 to 35 range, probably quite towards the end of that range. It's not something that I would have ever thought. But as a foodie, I guess I probably am, very narrow-minded in my approach to cooking and eating and shopping and travelling and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so if we look at the stats that Ollie's got here, you've got the under 25, so that's 18 to 25. Then we've got 25 to 34, then 35 to 44, 45 to 54, blah, blah, blah. The 25 to 34 is by far the largest group who consider themselves to be committed foodies, who really, really shape their lives through food, actually.
Yeah, and look, I think, in that, as I look back into my 25 to 34-year-old period before I had children, the reality is actually you do define yourself through interests, and therefore food is an interest area. foodies don't just eat to live. They kind of, they're passionate about creating
stuff. I'm at the other end of the scale, right? So you would think that...
In the 40 to 45 group, by me, yeah.
No, I'm above that one. I'm afraid I'm not even in the 45 to 54 one. I'm in the next one. So if you look at that, you would assume that people in my generation actually have learned to cook, you know, have possibly grown up with more skills around that, you know, et cetera, have the facility to cook, have you know, perhaps larger houses so you can cook. And yet they are under half what the 25 to 34 age range are, you know, who are committed foodies. I find that stunning.
But I think it's partially about the statements that you're looking at, which is it isn't, you know, the younger audience have grown up with more of an international food world. Mm. You know, there were Japanese restaurants, you know, in London when they were born. There were, you know, it wasn't just Chinese and Indian restaurants. There was this whole plethora of different things. Mexican cuisine was kind of more mainstream. So I think, you know, that younger group have experienced food in a different way. And it's now a topic of conversation. You know, when you take some statements to help define these people, things like, you know, I really enjoy talking about food and what I'm planning to eat. You know, that is something that has, you know, is a particular characteristic, and, you know, it's obviously something that...
And maybe they're better travelled, possibly.
Definitely. I mean, obviously, you know, with the EasyJets and Ryanairs of this world, you know, plane travel has become cheaper over the last, 20 years, and so people have travelled more broadly.
Yeah. And that does affect people's food choices as well, which we're going to come on to later, isn't it? But definitely travel and exposure to different countries and cultures does affect what you end up eating.
It's inspiring, isn't it? You know, you go on holiday and you try something new or amazing, or you have no idea what you're ordering, and then you try and recreate that when you get back home.
Successfully or unsuccessfully, depending.
Or otherwise, yeah.
Look, I think social media also, a role to play, which is you look at Instagram and it is a constant feed of food images, and so is Facebook, and so is other stuff. This is what I'm eating. And I think there is that, as I said, it's part of societal discussions nowadays. And so I think people are just, more into it.
Julie, is it a surprise to you that younger people are actually more into food on the face of it with this research than perhaps somebody from our generation?
Not at all. I think you're very right, because food is actually a part of now of how we construct our identity and express ourselves and discover who we are. And in particular, for a lot of younger people, they consider that journey of self-discovery, of constructing their identity, defining who they are, expressing who they are, as a main part of their life work. And food is an invaluable tool in not just figuring out yourself, do I like this, do I not like this, what does that mean about me, what am I putting in my body, and what does that make me, but then also giving you stuff to talk about, to show, to have stories around, and to create conversation. So it's probably the single most valuable tool you could have in your identity arsenal.
Do you think that's changed, though, versus... Would you have said what you've just said 20 years ago?
I think the currency you get, both kind of virtual but also actual physical currency you get from being able to express multiple parts of yourself and your identity, has increased. So you actually, you know, get money in your pocket for having these stories to tell and for showing these aspects of yourself out to the world. So I think it has changed.
I mean, you know, if you go back 20 years, were we not defining ourselves maybe more through music, maybe through fashion, and, you know, sport, maybe allegiances?
Yeah.
And now, I mean, I don't think, you know, growing up, I mean, I'm a massive foodie, but I don't think I really defined myself in my, you know, my teens and 20s, early 20s.
That's
necessarily
point.
As being that's a really good through point. Food.
And for my generation, and I'm hugely generalising, but, you know, music was a very big part of identity, what your identity was, what you dressed like, what you liked, what you listened to, who you, you know, went around with. Music very much shaped that, and fashion sort of hung around that bit as well. I'd never consider food as part of my identity because it just wasn't available, which I think is your point, isn't it, Julie?
Yeah, it's available, it's visual, it's experiential. It's both global and local, and it's really powerful.
And this ties into what we were discussing last week. I think we were talking about the growth of veganism and vegetarianism and pescatarianism, and actually how you were seeing that. I think one of my favourite stats is, according to the research, 0.0% of people over 65 are vegans. Now, I know that's not
0.0%.
true, because 0.0, that's not true, because my local MP is a vegan, and is over 65, I think, Mr. Corbyn. So, you know, that data point is not totally true. But, you know, there is a whole thing.
It's not captured in your survey.
No, he didn't answer it, sadly. Yeah. But, you know, there's definitely, it is a younger thing.
So the young are cooking. That's what's coming out of your research. Another thing is it's not a class thing. And it's not about how much money you have in your pocket either. And that's, we did touch on it a little bit last week. But that is a bit of a surprise to me. It felt like being a foodie is a luxurious thing as opposed to your values and your mindset, you know, despite your circumstances.
It's actually become even more democratized between the last survey we did and this survey.
Oh, so, really?
You know, if we look at committed foodies nowadays, 55% of them are ABC1 versus a national average of 56. I think the last time we did it was at 58 or 59%. So, you know, you're just seeing, I think, just a growing interest in the world of food. And I just don't think it's defined by socio-demographic.
And if you're a brand, then you have to be very, you have to be very careful and not make massive assumptions, because actually, if people are very interested in food and the provenance of food and cooking food from scratch, please don't assume they're middle-aged and rich, because that's not how it, that's not how it's panning out in your research at all.
No, it isn't. And I think that sort of, you know, I think, you know, if you again look back, a lot of brands spent a lot of time talking to, you know, the housewife as this kind of persona of who was going to be the decision maker. And I think there's also been a counterbalance that, which everyone goes, we're now targeting millennials. And you go,
It's about attitudes and behaviours.
Exactly.
It's not an age thing.
It's not a gender thing. It's actually about a group of people. And I think that's quite difficult for brands, because they often think through, I want to create a little box. And
yeah.
You're 25 to 34, you know, who thinks this and votes that. And
it doesn't work. It's tricky when you're talking about brands, because they come at two very, well, there's always a sliding scale with everything. But if you're talking about the big kind of supermarket-like brands, I think last week you maybe mentioned like the Persils and the Doves and those kind of things. Obviously not food, but, you know, big high street brands, for want of a better term. And then a lot of the people that we see on this show who have a smaller company and they're doing something artisanal or unique, or it's got this, you know, certain twist or angle on it, and they often have a much higher price point. And it's not because they're trying to attract people with more money, it's because it's, you know, more expensive to produce.
Yeah.
Whereas the guys who are these massive organizations and they're on all the supermarket shelves, they're trying to reach the masses, and, you know, therefore, you know, pitching something for a price point in the middle, and they've got the scale and all the economies that go with that.
Mm. The other thing that's come across is it's not about London either, is it? So again, you would assume that people who are really foodies, you know, that maybe they're not that young, maybe they've got a bit more money and they all live in London. That's not coming across either, is it?
No, look, I think, you know, let's remember what we're looking for is not the group of people who eat out the most or who've eaten in the widest range of restaurants. We're looking at people who engage in the topic of food. Look, it is clearly the case that London has a wider and more diverse collection of restaurants and a wider and more diverse and more easily available collection of ingredients, because we've got many more kind of diverse communities in London. But the truth of the matter is that does not mean you're foodie. You know, 18% of committed foodies are in London, but the rest of them are all over Britain, because, you know, like any of these things, you can be interested in food and live anywhere.
And I was fascinated by your map that you have in your research, where, you know, 18% of foodies are in London. For some reason, 7% in Scotland, but 3% in Wales. So tell me, why is it that Scottish people are more interested in food than Welsh? I mean, that's interesting. A double the number.
Yeah, I mean, but again, I think it's, you know, you've got, they're different things there. You've obviously got some major metropolitan areas which are much more kind of international, and you've got a population bias there, which obviously is, you know, Wales is a smaller population than Scotland, so in terms of the totality of it, they kind of they weigh out. It's not to say 3% of Wales is committed foodie, but 3% of committed foodies are in Wales.
Yeah.
So I think it's one of those things that, you know, the truth is, you know, we've got great friends who are based in Scotland, and there aren't a great number of great, you know, restaurants in the middle of nowhere. So actually, what do? You cook stuff from scratch.
Mm.
And actually, you get ingredients brought in. The internet has now allowed you, if you want a particular Mexican chili delivered the next day, your postman's bringing it.
But I do find that Welsh have got some amazing cheeses, and there's, you know, some great stuff around that. However, Scotland has a quite a good food reputation when you look at, you know, you look at the whiskey sort of culture and all the amazing, you know, whiskey that's produced there.
The salmon,
you know, the sort of venison and some of the seafood. I mean, I think in some ways that they're a bit more known for food.
Yeah, I mean, My honest thing is, I think that it's, as we said, I think it's not about where you live. I don't think it's about how old you are. I don't think it's about, you know, where you were brought up. It is genuinely just about, some people are into food, like some people are into football, and some people are into fashion or music. And I think there is this group of people who are living their life through the lens of food. And what's exciting about that is they are driving this revolution, not just in London, but throughout the country. And that means they're supporting the farmers markets and the farm shops and the butchers and the fishmongers, and they're starting the innovation. A lot of the people who come onto the show aren't all London-centric. No, they're actually trying to push things, you know, way beyond what's happening in the capital.
Do you have any data on other large cities where foodies are congregating? I mean, or did you just segment London and the rest of the UK?
No, we did segment more broadly. So we have got on a regional base. We haven't cut it that way yet. But I think it's one of those things that are interesting to look at different views on health and cooking and stuff in the regions. We haven't yet done that cut.
Interesting.
We also did it on religion, actually, interestingly. So we literally, because again, we haven't done that cut.
See if there's any correlation.
See correlation between, you know, if you are
vegan,
fit Christian, you know, Muslim, how does that affect what you're eating, what you're cooking, how foody you are, etc. We try to put as many variables in to see if there's anything you could pull apart.
And what I'd like to do is now look at what people are actually cooking, the ingredients that they feel comfortable with. There's some really interesting things. And last time we discussed this, I think it was about a year ago when your last research came out, we started looking at country cuisines and how people in their head classify what they're cooking. Because you said to me, oh, I've got a lot of people cooking French food. And I'm thinking, oh, I don't understand what French food. You go, yeah, but that could be, you know, croque monsieur. It could be, you know, a nice
bourguignon. I think we even said that about British food. We were like, what's British? And then we kind of went through the things like shepherd's pie.
So people are sort of this is how they're classifying. In terms of some of the, you know, the sort of global food and that people feel most comfortable with, Italian's right up there again, isn't it, as usual?
It is. And I think, you know, it's one of those things where you only need one dish to make a cuisine, you know, do you cook the following? It's like pasta, yes. Pizza, yes. Risotto, yes. So, you know, I argue the Italians
lasagna,
have three. Yeah. You've got three or four things which actually helps you take, you know, that. Whereas Moroccan,
tagine.
Take me beyond tagine, you know, at a national level.
Yeah.
But tagine gets you into the A-League. So the interesting thing in some ways is that individual countries with one dish can suddenly catapult up. And I think one needs to remember with this, we're asking, it's a self-selecting question.
Of course,
which is when you say, you know, do you cook, you know, which of the following cuisines do you cook at home? Chinese, you know, you may find that a world-class Chinese chef would not agree that this is Chinese food.
So just,
but
you
in
might,
the mind
you,
of the consumer,
you might just have a stir fry, and in your head, that's Chinese.
Yeah,
yeah.
And that's where the Chinese and the Indian cuisines and are so high up the spectrum.
So we've got here committed foodies, 99% say that they're cooking Italian. Probably no surprise, I would guess. 94% Chinese. Now I find that quite high, really. Because
that's regularly and occasionally, so it's both.
Regularly and occasionally. But, you know, I find that, you know, quite staggering. But then you've got, let's say, 91% people say they're cooking Spanish food. So what would that be, I guess? Paella?
I think that's anything with chorizo in it, is my honest view. Yeah, I do. I think that, again, is one of those anomalies.
Right.
You know, it's how a single ingredient will just...
And it is the best.
It's synonymous with a particular. But then you've got 83% of people are cooking Japanese. I mean, that's incredible. Making their own Japanese food.
But again, I think you're ticking there into sort of, you know, where are the boundaries of Japanese cuisine? And when you cut down into the regular, you know, you're down in the 20s on Japanese and stuff. So I think certainly Japanese and Moroccan are much more kind of emerging cuisines. But the interesting thing actually is that when you look at the numbers around British food, you know, what percent, you know, we say to people, what percentage of the food you're cooking do you consider British? And, you know, a lot of people consider that they are cooking an international range of cuisines. And we obviously don't have the data, but it'd be interesting, you know, if you dropped into the same piece of research in France or Italy or Spain, I don't think you'd get the numbers that we have here. I think we are much more international in our outlook, and certainly if you compare the older audience versus the younger audience and how they describe their food, you know, the younger audience do not describe their food as British. They describe it as international, experimental, Right, the older audience will be more kind of British as well.
Sunday lunch, though, isn't it? Sunday lunch, that's British.
Maybe that's what most people Sunday are calling lunch. It. Yeah.
You know, and cooked breakfast, that's British.
But it's shepherd's pie and it's cottage pie. But Julie,
from your perspective, I know you do all sorts of research, you know, internationally. Do you find that the British people are particularly international in their outlook on food compared to other countries?
It's a very good question. I mean, we've spent a lot of time in people's kitchens, cooking with them around the world. And I think it's partly down to ingredients. As you said, sort of, I think the British supermarket offers a lot of clearly labeled, easy access into different cuisines, where in other supermarkets, when you kind of go down the aisle, it's not so easy to find the Mexican section, the Chinese section, the, you know.
Because they don't have those sections full stop. Mm. Yeah, they're just scattered about.
I think that the supermarkets and the shops do a great job of curating the choices for the British cook. And also, I think this point of travel, the sense of constantly wanting to remind yourself of where you've been, what you've experienced, where you've gone. When I go to Russia, people do that by the magnets on their fridge. So it's not necessarily by what they're cooking, but they've got, you know, every place they visit, there's a magnet that reminds them. And I think perhaps the you know, it's the reminder of the holiday, of the trip, of the places we've been.
But you're saying then, if you're talking about Russia versus here, and I know we're generalising, but you're saying that their badge of having been somewhere might not necessarily be food or recreating the food at home.
No, and instead, if I open their freezer, what I'm going to see is the bags of fruit and produce that they've brought back from the dasha over the summer that they've stocked up to, that represents kind of that slice of producing your own food and not being reliant on kind of the infrastructure and the shops to get it to you. So so it's going to be a different range of things.
Interesting. Another thing that we were talking about last week, which we were so excited about, is the rise of the local fishmonger and the local butcher and all that. Now, you've done some research in this year's so about protein cooking. What do you mean by that term?
So what we're asking here is which of the following have you cooked in the last 6 months? Mm. And what we try and get a read on here is what people are cooking. Now, that could be from scratch. I mean, it could be raw scallops. You know, it could be scallops in an Iceland frozen scallop dish.
No.
No, I know, but I mean that's still defined as cooked. So you have to accept this. So you have to look at this as being they have cooked something with that in it. So a salmon ready meal. You know, have you cooked salmon at home? Yes, I have cooked salmon at home. So this is showing a sort of a lens on what people are embracing. And I think what's interesting about it is, you know, some of the fish that we really should be eating more of, like mackerel. You know, less than a quarter of people are eating. And things that I adore, like crab, you know.
Me too. So if I give you some, I'll give you some of these stats here. So we've got the national picture, and then we've got these committed foodies. National picture, 23% say that they have cooked in the past year, mackerel.
Yep.
Is that right? 40% committed foodies. Now, mackerel's so cheap.
Sorry, 6 months. Last six months.
Mackerel's so cheap, so good for you, you know, and it's just, I mean, just fry it on each side. It's not hard, is it? It's not a hard thing to cook.
Turn it into pate.
Mind you, say the same with all fish, actually. It is. Fry it on one side and fry it on the other side and you're done. It's not hard. But people seem to be frightened about cooking fish
but
sometimes.
But I suppose on one level, you've got to put 30% as being, if you're above 30%, you're a mass market protein. Right, because your total food is 30%. So if you can tip in, you know, if you kind of sort of say, well, you know, if you take sea bass, for example, what that's really telling you is most foodies cook sea bass, probably, but not all.
But only 23% of the population.
Exactly. Yeah. So obviously not every food, so you've obviously got to...
But if you look at cod, though, of course, which feels like a very traditional British fish that people feel comfortable with, possibly because of fish and chip shops, I don't know. 60% of people across the country have cooked that in the last 6 months. 70% of foodies, you know, not as massive a difference, but it's still a hugely popular fish.
It is, but I think, you know, where foodies are beginning to experiment, and again with the rise of fishmongers, is they are walking into a fishmonger and saying, you know, what's that? Mm. And you have the fun moment where they say, oh, it's a gurnard. And you're like, what's a gurnard?
It's one of the ugliest fishes you've ever seen.
It is, and one of the most delicious.
And it's full of bones and quite difficult to fill it, but it's lovely. But it's a lovely fish, yeah. Salmon, 53%, nationally being cooked, and 69% of committed foodies. Again, same sort of level as cod.
And look, so, you know, we've had salmon on croûte since the 1970s. Yeah. So I think some of these dishes are things that, you know, it's like the fish and chips, the salmon on croûte. Mm. But, you know, you come into the monk fishes and, you know, wind back, what, 20 years and you couldn't give the things away. You know, now they're incredibly expensive and rightly priced.
I'm really disappointed to see crab. I mean, for me, crab is one of the great joys, really. And especially crab cakes. I mean, wow, amazing. And I always think of crab as being traditionally British somehow and cheap, actually, or used to be. Nationally, only 10% had crab in the last 6 months. Committed food is 24%. That's quite low.
It is. I say, I made a crab soup the other day, which involved blending the crab shells.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, you need a Vitamix or something that's really, really powerful to make it happen. But I said the noise it makes is quite extraordinary. But at the end, you get this really incredible soup base.
They are amazing blenders.
Don't do that at home with a normal blender.
Yeah, it will kill.
Before we move on, there's I think 8 different fish or seafood here, I guess, if you include crab. Was this the only 8 that were on the list, or are these the top 8 that made the cut?
No, so that was those were the only 8 that were on the list. We asked also fish and seafood separately.
Right.
We have done the thing where we've included every single protein we could possibly think of once, but you really need a foodie audience to keep going.
Well, I wondered if it was like a free entry or whether there was like, you know, check boxes or whatever.
No, so it's check boxes to try and get a read.
And what about meat? What are we seeing in the sort of meat world?
So we didn't include chicken because chicken is basically eaten by everyone.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, beef's at the top of the list, you know, and lamb is high up there with 60%. But you know, things like duck, you know, 27% of people are cooking it. Again, more expensive. I mean, the things for me which are worrying is, you know, venison. I mean, venison is, you know, very much something that we should be, you know, eating here. It's lean, it's, you know, we've got a lot of deer. You know, it's 12%.
Mm-hmm.
And actually the other day we bought some venison for the office because we're testing a recipe. And the venison came from New Zealand.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
And I have to ask the question, what on earth is going on? I mean, you buy venison on, you know, a supermarket. And
It's funny you say that. I've actually heard somewhere, and I would need to go and double check the source on this, but I remember somebody saying that lamb that is farmed or grown or whatever, however you describe it, in New Zealand is actually from a more sustainable source than if you were to get Welsh lamb. And I'm not entirely sure why that is, because there's a lot of air miles involved, but I definitely remember seeing it. And the stat has stuck in my head. But
might have to dig that out.
Yeah, I'm going to need to look it up. Yeah. But really interesting.
Julie, any trends you're seeing on meat? I mean, we're hearing quite a lot, and we have seen it in Ollie's research, about more people wanting to have more of a plant-based diet. Are you seeing any trends in terms of meat as opposed to fish?
I think, obviously, just protein in general is a trend. So I think, regardless of source, seeing a lot of emphasis on protein amongst the macronutrients. Which,
so what do you mean by that? As in people wanting to consume more
high protein?
Higher protein. Mm. I think by definition, then that starts to spread the search to kind of explore different sources.
And hence the growth in peanut butter and things like that, because a lot of athletes or people going to the gym or people who want to try and get a little bit fit, there's sort of an urban myth, I mean, whether it's true or not, I don't know, is you need lots of protein because that's going to help you recover quicker, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So we've got a lot of people with very high protein levels in their diet. Don't know whether that's good for you or not, but hence the rise, I think, of things like peanut butter.
Mm.
But there's also a rise of alternative proteins as well. So not just your meats, but your plant-based proteins. So pea protein, I think, is a big one that is kind of trending. Mushroom protein, I'm starting to see in a few different places, which is interesting.
Hemp.
Hemp as well. I think it was last time you were on, you bought some hemp-based product or there was something in there. Yeah, really, really interesting.
Hmm.
It's interesting. So apparently 8% of the UK regularly take a protein shake, a nutritional shake, with protein powder, coconut water. I don't get them. I mean,
you're working out,
go and eat an egg. Boil an egg. Just something. I don't understand that.
I mean, it's a big thing, isn't it?
It's a big thing. All you have to do is start scrolling through kind of the Fitspiration stuff on Instagram, And you've got to have the protein shake in there. You've got to have the protein porridge. You've got the list goes on and on.
But where do you think? Because one of the things I find quite interesting about the whole growth of people saying I want to eat less meat and I want to follow more of a plant-based diet. Where do you see this opportunity going for brands? I mean, how do you think brands are kind of exploit that territory? Because on one level, for me, it takes me to vegetables, and I'm like, great, we're with broccoli and cauliflower, but it's clearly that's not going to be the only solution. They're going to be more interventionist solutions, aren't there, from brands?
Yeah, I think it's going to go multiple ways. I think if you're really interested in a plant-based diet because of things like the microbiome and really encouraging different types of bacteria to grow in your body, then you're going to have to go for a really wide diversity of fiber, lots of vegetables, lots of fruit, and the key is to get as many different types of fiber
and fermented food as well
as possible. Mm. Where I think there's probably another track where people aren't necessarily as concerned with the effect of what they're consuming, but the label of what they're consuming, they're going to look more for the substitute solutions, the things that are kind of pre-made without the animal sources, but recreate an animal-like experience. And that's going to be a bit more synthetic, maybe a bit less nutritious, but more convenient, easier, and gives you the sense of
getting there, even though if you're not doing it quite properly, you're sort of nearly there.
Well, I think it kind of comes into two parts. I think there's a lot of movement into plant-based for like health reasons, or for the nutritional content of not avoiding animal products like meat and dairy. But I think there's also then the sustainability angle or the ethical angle, which is I can make a choice to not eat animal products because they don't believe in the way that it's farmed or what have you.
I do think though that there's this level of trust. What can you do to a broccoli as opposed to
ruin a broccoli?
It arrives at the supermarket or wherever you're getting it, as opposed to sausages which you don't even know what country it comes from or what's in it. And I think part of if you see veg and fruit that it's going to be okay.
But that's probably not the case with all of these synthetically produced things like corn and even some. When I did Veganuary, I bought a whole load of these just to test them out. Things like chicken strips, and I'm doing inverted commas, which of course you can't see, and these kind of meat-like substitutes,
I don't get that.
Yeah, it was pretty horrible, to be honest.
I can imagine.
But then there's more natural stuff like jackfruit and tempeh and stuff like that, which is a bit more interesting.
Cultured meat is going to be the next.
Yeah, absolutely.
The next challenging, interesting.
Mm. What's that mean? Cultured meat.
So it's grown in a laboratory. So whether obviously Julie,
I thought you meant cultured as in it's well read. Well read meat.
Meat that's grown in a laboratory rather than on a farm.
Well, but it's interesting. We were talking to a shoemaker the other day who said that is that is the future. They are now they're so appalled by the way that actually most leathers produced and stuff, company called Pozu, and literally all they're doing, they're now looking at that kind of stuff and how to turn things like coconut husks into shoes, and it's all about sustainable
plastic the same, isn't it?
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
So moving on, do you remember who had that lovely chap whose name I forget who runs Sous Vide Tools?
Alex.
Do you remember Shannon. Alex? Yeah, we had that really good program. He's funny and great. And do you remember I said I was looking and I might order one of those Sous Vide machines?
I think you were bashing them a lot first.
Do you remember? Well, no, would I do that? And we're going to go on to your stats in a minute for the high-tech kitchen and for kitchen tools. Anyway, I bought one.
Well done. Welcome to the revolution.
And bought a dehydration unit, one of those ones he was talking about. Because he was saying that for him, dehydrating is a big thing. It's a new trend, dehydrating your own fruit and maybe jerky and things like that, because where it's come from. Anyway, I've made you some.
This is an exciting moment.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Are you impressed?
I'm very impressed.
They look very pretty. It's interesting.
I'm wondering if this is going to be one of your trends, Ollie. So I've made you some dehydrated tomato, and all I did is get one of those machines, switch it on, and just cut some slices of tomato, shoved it in that machine, and this is what came out. What do you reckon?
So I'm really interested. How fine? Just describe them. They're incredibly fine, and they're in sort of rings of tomatoes. How finely did you slice them?
Oh, no, I just did it with a knife because I didn't have a mandolin.
Right, okay.
So I just cut it as thinly as I could manage with a knife. I should say,
Sue has all her fingers, from what I can tell. They look all real.
They're really good.
Yeah.
I'm very impressed.
They're quite sharp. I mean, tomato, when you cook it, normally you
didn't
need
put anything on it at all.
You need a bit of salt or sugar or something to take the bitterness away. But
when I did these experiment, because I knew you lot would take the mickey. So my favourite are the oranges, actually.
I made some
roast duck the other week, and I made some plum sauce, and those are like three plums that really had it. They were nearly rotten. So I thought, oh, I'll use them. Because good use of stuff that's just about to go off.
See, what I really like about dry fruit, is I love guilty pleasure of mine, fruit pastels.
No, I don't like that at all.
See, I really like the chewy things.
No, that needs to be in there for a bit longer, though. It's not crispy enough.
No, I like the chewy bits.
Do you? Well, I think the tomatoes are spot on. Don't you think?
Mm. I'm loving the fruit.
Oh, you like the fruit? Taste the orange one. The orange one is definitely the best. I love that.
And it's got the skin on it as well.
It's the best bit. Yeah, have a bit. So,
I love the apple.
Oh, no, that needs doing longer. That's a bit too chewy.
I think what's interesting about this kind of stuff is, and this is why I think people are enjoying sort of what we call the DIY food revolution, is it's fun to do. And, it's, you know, how much more interesting is it than saying, yeah, no, I dried these apples myself? Then actually, you know,
I only did it to annoy you, though, Ollie. No,
yeah, but we all have people around for dinner that it's fun to. I remember once serving squirrel to some of my guests.
Squirrel,
and I think they've ever recovered.
Did they ever come back again? Probably not.
I don't think I've spoken. No, no. I have. I have.
I hear it tastes like chicken.
It was a memorable moment where they said, "What's this?" I said, "Squirrel."
I might do that. Where'd you get it from? Did you shoot it yourself?
Online butcher.
Or it just fell down dead from your tree in the garden. Thought I'll use that, a bit of roadkill.
North London squirrel. Yeah.
No, definitely not. What do you think of the orange? I love it because it's like tart.
It's very bitter.
Like Christmas, isn't it?
It's like Seville oranges, I think. It's nice. I like that.
But this has been massive, hasn't it? The whole dried fruit thing. I mean, that is a category that's exploded, isn't it?
Well, it adds a whole new dimension of texture to what's familiar. So, again, all that sensory, experiential, discovering something new and something that you thought that you already knew is really fun.
Than crisps, I think. And these tomatoes, I think, are fab. So why would I buy a packet of crisps when I can just, you know, got some tomatoes that just roughly pass their sell-by date, just, you know, slice them up, leave them in this machine, and nice.
And you feel virtuous because you're not throwing them away?
Yeah. No, it's a great way to kind of prevent food
Ollie,
waste.
Don't do that. So Ollie's just pointing out that I've left a pip in one of the orange slices. Sorry about that.
Right. Added textural interest.
Yeah. Well, it's authentic. It's authentic.
So I said to one of my team, the great Polly, she does a lot of our recipe testing. I said, go on, Polly, what would you do with a dehydrator? So she said, well, the only way to make a proper mashed potato is to do roast potatoes and then scoop out the inside. So then use that because it's a dry potato. You haven't wet it. Mm. And then she said, then you dehydrate the skins to the point where basically they're completely dry. And then you blitz them into a dust. So you sprinkle.
Definitely can't be bothered to do any of that.
This is great. You can then sprinkle the dust of the potatoes onto the mashed potatoes.
Wow.
Apparently, it's amazing.
But there's loads of flavour in there as well.
I haven't got time to do all that sort of
thing. While you're doing all this drying, you can be driving a potato skin.
True, but
I'm having a go at the apples.
So I had a go with the old dehydrator, and then I had a go at sous viding. Having said my whole life through this show for 2 years running, I thought it was rubbish. It was amazing.
So what did you like about it?
I'm just confessing here. It was amazing.
So what?
The control, I think. And it's not just cooking one thing. If you had eight people, which I regularly cook for quite a lot of people, you know, you could cook eight pieces of chicken or eight, you know, portions of duck, and you know they'd be exactly right. And you just flash fry them. I can see why people think that control's so good. I did the egg thing. Do you remember he said? He said, right, you can do an egg for, I can't remember what it was. And then you actually crack open the shell and a poached egg pops out. I didn't like that much.
Didn't like that.
No.
I think it's great for entertaining.
Tried it.
I mean, I think, this is what I think is going to be interesting about how technology plays out in the preparation of food going forward is, there's so many gizmos out there. There are so many pointless things that none of us need in our lives.
And actually, I guess we hadn't bought a chocolate fountain. We took the mickey out of him for the whole programme.
Stefan from Heartier, wasn't it?
That's right.
But it's interesting, isn't it? You know, that actually, you know, we've all had lots of things like fondue makers and chocolate fountains. You know, there have been trends or spiralizers. And I think what's interesting for me about sous vide is I think it is a modern way of cooking and a technically interesting way of cooking. Mm. It's for me a little bit like the hot water tap, which I haven't still got my head around. You know, the boiling water tap where you just press it and
instant hot water.
Which I can't quite work out if I like, because I think as a part of me, it makes me sound like 85. Like, I like the idea of putting the kettle on.
Really? And having a matching toaster as well.
No,
because you can't.
Yeah. You just need one of those like hand knitted jumpers. You're sitting in the corner with your slippers on, and then you go and put the kettle on. You like the thought of it.
It's like you know,
worryingly, that sounds like me actually.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I mean,
like the thought. Of no, I like. The kettle on.
I mean, it's sort of like you go and put the kettle on, then you wait a minute and you wait for it to boil. There's like a process, and I don't know. So for me, somehow the instant hot water tap, I haven't got. Have you got your head around the head?
I still don't believe that they get hot enough.
Right.
And I read the spec sheet and I know it says 100 degrees Celsius, but I don't quite trust it yet.
Interesting. Hmm. And for you, that means the tea or coffee isn't going to be
spot on. Tea, yeah. Coffee, you want it to come a little bit below, but yeah.
Hmm. Can you control that on the tap? So I don't know
how to. No,
I don't think you can.
Anyway, going back to the research.
Yes, sorry.
A little bit of diversion there. The point of me bringing these in, just so that I can confess that I now have a sous vide machine, is gadgets are big, aren't they? And you're saying food is. I'm quite bought into that. Although one of the theories I think that you have been saying on the show a few times is that gadgets last if they're in the professional kitchen more often. You know, they're here to stay more often because I guess because they're proven in a professional sense.
Yeah, and I think if they have a genuine role and if consumers can work out how to use them, I think there's a test that you have. And, you know, if you buy something and you unwrap it and you use it once and then you kind of never really, and it doesn't really work the first time, you don't get some form of instant gratification. Mm. You're out. I mean, to take your example, you know, you bought your dehydrator, you're happy with the results, you'll keep using it.
Well, I wasn't keen on the apple, but the rest are good.
The rest are good. But, you know, so I think you do need these things to work, and then you need to carve out a role for them in your kind of cooking life. So, you know, look, we all know our iPhones, our ovens, our computers all do things that we never use. And there's that kind of game of actually working out how you make sure that the device is doing something you need. And then, you know, you quickly adopt those small numbers of behaviours.
Adopt and adapt.
Mm. Exactly. And if you can't find a role for the thing, it just collects dust and eventually... Yeah.
And what percentages and stats have you got on the you know, the sort of gadgets at the moment?
Sous vide amongst real foodies is at 10%. So welcome to the 10% club. So 10% of the 17%.
Is that what you would expect? No, or is that quite low?
I think that's you know, it's gaining pace. You know, I mean, you know, as Alex was saying the other day, he's opening a store there in John Lewis. There's a whole kind of interest, I think, in that method of cooking. I think what you're seeing is the adoption of what I'll call the stuff that allows you to do things from scratch. So the sort of, you know, home smokers and some of that kind of stuff. But also I think it's the fun and playful things, you know. So I was joking last week about the fact that 38% of Jedis own blowtorches.
Oh, that's right.
You know, it's that kind of stuff, which also has a bit of flamboyance around it, allows you to show off, allows you to do kind of, you know, interesting things. But the truth is the things that most people have are what you'd expect. Kettles, toasters, and stuff. But interestingly, even the toaster isn't 100%. It's like in the high 80s, which I'm a bit like, really? You know?
So somebody doesn't have a toaster.
Yeah, no, I remember looking at this data the first time and going, and kettles.
They probably have an auger, because you can do the toast on them.
Maybe.
In some of the questions that you asked, there were things like, how often do you do it as well? Like, are you a regular cooker of Seabass, or, you know, occasional or whatever? It would be interesting to know. These are people who said they own one of these things, but to get that kind of split on whether they have them is one thing, but do they actually use them on a regular basis?
So we can get to that, but we haven't got there yet, because we asked another whole thing about which of the following tasks you do. So the protein quote I gave earlier was from a list of tasks we came up with. So do you make smoothies? Do you make milkshakes? Do you slow cook meat? Do you pan fry fish? We've got a load of those, and obviously we can then cross tabulate that with what do people own. But what's interesting is we are seeing the rise of the hot water tap, instant boiling water tap. We're seeing the rise of induction, you know, which are all about control and about precision. but also show that people are investing in their kitchens.
Yeah.
And they're spending money to create a much more modern kitchen than I think you know many of us expected.
But Julie, I wouldn't, in a way, I wouldn't expect that. You know, so many people are saying that people aren't cooking, they're not having a kitchen. Some, you know, apartments haven't even got kitchens, you know, now. And that seems extraordinary that people are actually investing in kitchens and in you know, and some of this stuff's blooming costly.
Well, and I think sort of like with cars, people have discovered that just because you have a small kitchen doesn't mean you don't want to spend money on it and put high quality performance appliances into it. And so there's much less of a, the nice appliances have to come with a big kitchen and the big house and all of that. You're going to, if you like to cook, you're going to find a way to put together the right tools.
And maybe if those tools are very efficient, actually you're saving space.
Absolutely.
Possibly. Yeah, yeah. Is there a gender split on some of these the gadgets?
You've entered the sous vide crew are slightly more male than they are female. You will be not surprised the home smokers and stuff lean male.
Really?
You know, deep fat fryers, for some reason men again. You know, and blenders and sort of smoothie makers, you know, have more of a female profile, as do stand mixers. So you find that sort of, you know, there is still that.
So if it looks like a gun, it's more likely to be a boy that's going to buy it.
If it looks like a gun or involves fire, it probably makes men feel that they're doing their job in the kitchen. Or precision. And I think precision is an interesting one, which is where the sous vides and that kind of stuff comes into play.
I mean, we are being, you know, politically incorrect here, but there's still that bias you're seeing.
Yeah. I mean, it's not politically incorrect. I mean,
it's just a fact of who
takes on what. And look, there are lots of differences. From a gender perspective in terms of, you know, who's eating more healthily, who's, you know, wanting to eat different proteins and different fish. There's a whole range of stuff. And I think that's one of the challenges, which is, again, you know, you've got to sort of take that into account when you are targeting different groups of consumers.
And what are you seeing in terms of online ordering? Is there any sort of, you know, I mean, we did talk about takeaways and all that sort of stuff last week, are you getting the feeling that people are embracing that technology and are very comfortable ordering stuff online? And that's both, let's say, Ocado and ordering takeaway food or whatever to be delivered.
So we've certainly seen an increase in the regularity of people claiming to order their groceries online. Now that also is then counterweighted by the growth of fishmongers and butchers. So I think you've got two different things going on, where there's a group of people who are happy to embrace the online revolution from a sort of grocery ordering perspective, but they're also seeking the real world for sort of different stuff. And I think, but there's still 50% of people who never.
Yeah, that was one of the things that really surprised me. It was like 43% never using online ordering. Yeah. But then it's a 6% increase from 2017 to 18 about people who are regularly buying online.
But I think in some ways it's interesting. My mother, for the first time, managed to order, you know, her groceries online. Now, she's massively into food. She, you know, she's, you know, time rich, so she kind of would happily wander around the supermarket and choose things. So I think, you know, I think the online thing really suits, you know, busy working families, you know, more than anyone else, and people who are disengaged.
Online's good for me when it's really heavy stuff. I mean, if I want to order 12 bottles of wine, it's a real pain wondering, you know, trying to sort that out in the car. Or if I order big, chunky, you know, bottles of, let's say, dishwasher tablets. But do you know what I mean?
Or
a bottle of sort of fabric softener or something. Those are all really heavy things. I'm quite happy to order those online because I don't have to touch and feel the quality of it. I know exactly what it is. It's a commodity, in essence.
And I think that's the big difference. I think there's a growth in commodity grocery shopping. The definition of commodity in grocery shopping is clearly personal.
Yeah.
So what may be your, you know, commodity, maybe someone else is kind of highly involved. Like for me, wine, I want to go to my local wine shop.
Yeah, but toilet rolls, I mean, I don't actually look at them. No.
We have an Amazon push button for a toilet roll now. So when you run out, you press the button. A day later,
don't tell me,
96 rolls of Andrex in a big cardboard box.
It's no good with you. You want it now when you're sitting there, don't you? Somebody suddenly turns up 2 minutes later.
Do you know, I have to say, my favourite roll of toilet roll is I have a Donald Trump faced toilet roll.
Which
a friend of mine brought back. I'm really determined. Someone keeps saying, you know, I'm not sure I can use it. It's sitting there. I think as every day goes past, it feels like we should have more of those. Maybe Amazon do the regular replenish your Donald Trump toilet roll.
They might say, do. You can program it for anything you want.
Anybody listening, don't ever, ever go around to Ollie's house if you're invited. First of all, you're going to get served roadkill squirrel. And then when you go to the loo, you're faced with Donald Trump. Don't go. I'm still amazed that you're married, actually, Ollie. But anyway, yes. Can I just also now swiftly move on and to the role of supermarkets then? So if we've got this online ordering going on for different things and for different reasons and different situations, what is the role of the supermarket going to be, in your view, Julie? Let's say not 2 years' time, 3 years' time, maybe 10, 15 years' time.
The role of any physical shopping location over time has to be about the experience.
Right.
It's really about the experiential value, the ephemeral value, the connectivity that you get that makes being in that place at that time with those people worthwhile.
Do you think that's why they rise in butchers and fishmongers then, Ollie?
I think so. But then where does that leave? If you play that forward, so does that mean toilet roll is not going to be sold? You know, do all those categories vanish?
Potentially. Space is money, right? And when you think about the available frontage to give choice, particularly if I live in quite a rural location, my choice is very, very severely, you know, limited by the space it takes up, and so if you can get higher value, more experiential products in there to drive the value, definitely.
But isn't it interesting because in a local supermarket in a major metropolitan area, I understand there is a limited amount of space and you've got to be careful on that. But these retailers have invested in so many massive out of town spaces. Mm. How do they resolve that?
I think they're struggling with that anyway. I mean, I don't want that much choice. I've completely stopped going to those because I just find them unnecessary, and I actually find them, I don't know, almost a bit showy offy, and I don't understand why they're needed. And then they fill them with coffee shops that nobody really sits in, and there's, you know, and then they start selling flowers, and then they start selling CDs, and then they start. That's not what I want my supermarket to be.
But what do they do with that real estate?
I mean, I don't know. But some of them are
struggling.
Housing.
It would be interesting to see how some of the things that we're being experimented on in the States at the moment, like with Amazon Go, as this, you know, supermarket of the future where there's no cash registers. You just walk in, it recognises who you are, picks you up by your Amazon profile, you just pick stuff off the shelf and walk out. It would be interesting to see how things like that evolve.
Interesting. So we included for the first time Amazon Fresh in our research, which we, you know, never done before. And, you know, 3% of people claim to be shopping Amazon Fresh regularly.
Amazon Fresh is
Amazon. Online.
So it's their fruit and veg on-demand delivery. It's one of the smallest parts of their business.
Yeah, but
it's going to grow.
But what I'm saying is, I'm like you. I'm quite interested in the shop that they've got where Amazon Go.
Yeah.
You know, is that going to transform the supermarket where you don't have to? You know, you don't have a checkout. I mean, how wonderful would that be? You don't have a checkout and you don't have to pay. It just all gets automatically done as you wander in and wander out. A stunning piece
not
of technology.
Great for employment, but
no.
Those are the interesting. I mean, this is where I think that's a really interesting thing. Which is, on one level, here you are asking for a grocery experience that is people-less.
Yeah, and on the other hand, I'm saying I want to go and talk to my local butcher
and say,
which is ridiculous. You know,
Where's my brisket from? Yeah. But again, for me, it's about the involved categories versus the uninvolved categories.
I think you're right.
And I think what becomes really difficult for brands, I think, it's one of the really most complicated spaces. So as you start to lose those storefronts, how do you get discovered?
Yeah.
You know, because the truth is, when you start to move into online shopping, you head into your favorites box, you go tick, 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 done. You know, it's a completely uninvolved thing. And actually, I went to a supermarket the other day when I was in France, and, you know, I'm like, oh, wow, look at all this stuff. But actually, you know, here, I just don't go to them. So you don't discover a lot of these new brands.
Yeah.
So I think it does make it quite difficult for those emerging food brands and stuff to
play. So I think what we're saying then, Julie, is that we might well see a split in very different types of shopping depending on stuff we want to be involved with and stuff we don't want to be involved with.
Definitely.
And those two things will polarise more, possibly.
And you don't want the same experience, you don't have the same needs every single time either. Yeah. So, you know, the very high-end, interesting new brand or, you know, experiential grocery store, you might go to once a month, love it. And then you do your weekly shop another way. And so it's not like you're stuck in one channel all the time. Shopping is something that you do usually multiple times per week. So you as a consumer can...
In different moods for different occasions, you know, whatever. Yeah. Unbelievably, we're nearly running out of time again, Ollie. Is there anything in the research again that you'd just like to draw our attention to before we end the programme?
I think we've discussed so much in some ways. I think that what's interesting really for me is that, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about the foodie and the 30% of the UK that's really committed to food. And we haven't spent a lot of time talking about the other end of the spectrum, people who are really disengaged with food. And I think, you know, that's something that is actually also, interestingly, a massive opportunity. It's not our space, and it's not a lot of the spaces, a lot of the food brands that we talk to on this show. But actually, it is 70% of the UK is disengaged in the world of food. And there's a really interesting challenge, I think, for brands out there, which is how do you engage that community on their level in the right way? Because it's certainly not through the heightened food queues and all the stuff that we're doing.
And is it because they don't like food, or they get no joy from food, or they find it complicated and frightening and can't cook? You know, there could be all sorts of reasons why people aren't engaged.
All sorts. And some might just be, it's not their top priority, so that they enjoy food and they like doing a nice dish, but it's not what drives their kind of their lens on the world. So I think, you know, this is where brands, I think, are going to have to polarise, which is, are you going after that foodie audience, in which case you've got to up your game, you've got to really tell a really good story. Or if you're not doing that, sure as hell, don't talk about all the kind of foodie cues, because that's going to totally turn off that other 70%.
Absolutely. I can really applaud Great British Chefs really for doing this research, because it's very, very comprehensive. For any of you who would like to access it, you just need to go onto, is it Great British Chefs?
Yeah, so in the footer of our website, you'll find a little tab called Insight and Consultancy, and down there you can download our white papers for free. There are a whole load of them. And, you know, we're always interested in talking to people who, you know, want to find out more about our research and want to understand more. And, you know, to be honest, I see so many reports that go out there that reference data from, you know, I saw one the other day, from 2008.
Old. I mean, how
and actually, you know,
that?
It's really important that we are basing our decisions on what's actually happening in the UK. So if you're doing some interesting work, you know, please do reach out to us and see how we can help.
And not making assumptions and not generalising where you've totally got it wrong. So if you're involved in food, if you're a brand, if you're just interested in food full stop, or you're trying to plan new products, you probably do really need to find out what these are about. So go on to that. I'd just like to say thank you so much to Julie. Thank you, Julie. And Julie Bennett is from Precipice Design. If you want to know about Precipice Design, it's precipice-design.com. There's some great, great articles on there about the future and future gazing. And thank you for your expertise today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you, Guy. We love all this stuff, don't we?
Yeah, it's brilliant. And it's great to have some hard numbers to look at as well.
Yeah, it is.
Things that we wouldn't have expected.
Indeed. So you've been listening to the Food Talk Show. Please go onto our website if you want to get a link to that research, or to find out any of the other interesting topics we've covered on our podcast. If you want to get in touch with us via Twitter, if you've got any views on that research or any of your own insights, please contact us on @FoodTalkShow. That's our Twitter feed. And we're looking forward to seeing you next week. And have a good week. Bye now.